I think on Wednesday, we were getting ready to start chapter 5 for the most part. So we'll be starting in Deuteronomy, the 5th chapter this morning. And I guess this kind of begins the section of the law. And in, at the end of the 4th chapter there, he kind of starts what I would call an introduction to the law, restates where they are, which I think I've said that about 100 times in here. They're waiting there east of the Jordan River to cross over into the land. And so now we're going to see here in chapter 5 that this is going to be the start of what is like the comprehensive body of laws that they're going to have. And this is, and I think I said this on Wednesday. I can't remember what I said. But I think we talked about how the Deuteronomy is going to be more of instruction for their daily living, where Leviticus had a lot more to do with the, how the Levites and the priests were supposed to perform their sacrifice. And so also another thing we can see is whenever they made the covenant at Mount Sinai, that was with basically the parents of this generation. And so now we're going to see that this is going to be a renewal of the covenant with the new generation, because the first generation kept the covenant so well that they said, we just want to go over this real quick, right? No, because the first generation had failed in keeping the covenant. They had lost their faith in the wilderness. They were too afraid to enter the land. And so God is going to, through Moses, is going to reestablish his covenant with this second generation, so that they will go in and not fail in keeping the covenant, but they are going to go in and conquer the land. And so we see that now they're going to make a new covenant with them. And it's basically the same covenant, same cursings and blessings, but it kind of personalizes it to them. And I think another thing it does, it's going to remind them of how not to do things and how to do things. And so let's look at chapter 5 and verse 6. And I think this is this is a beginning statement here. It says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. So as he is beginning to give them the law, what does he tell them? I am the Lord your God. You remember what he told Moses at the burning bush? Who am I supposed to say is sending me? All right, the I am, right? And that's two very small words, because only three letters there, but that is a very huge, huge statement that God makes. And so I think that it's no coincidence that this is the same words that are used here in this statement. I am the Lord your God. And he qualifies that how? I brought you out of slavery and out of Egypt. And I think we talked, if my memory is correct, I think we talked about how on Wednesday, how he reminded them that look back in history, had anything like this ever happened before? Had a God ever gone and taken a group of people out of another nation and brought them out of slavery and set them up? So he reminds them of those things, and we see that clearly they recognize that, that has never happened before.
Yeah, one thing that's really significant here is the people of Israel, they did nothing themselves. They never raised a weapon to fight against the Egyptians. They never did anything to deliver themselves. God made it very clear, I'm the one who did all of this. They were just being led by God.
Yeah. That's a very good point. In fact, not only did they not do anything, they kind of fought against it a little bit, right? But even, they were questioning all this throughout the whole thing. And even in the wilderness, they were saying, you brought us out here to let us die. And so they had rejected God. And clearly, we see that they weren't a military strength. They didn't have any means or know-how to fight. And so God, everything that had happened, God had basically done it for them. So, thank you for that point. That's a very good point. And so he's going to begin here, and he's going to kind of go through and give them some commands, and he's going to restate the Ten Commandments. And so he says, I'm the Lord your God. He said, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of which is in heaven above or on earth beneath or water under the earth. All right, and so here he kind of restates this. He's already made this kind of statement today. And even in, I think in chapter 4, he goes and makes a list of the different types of things they weren't allowed to make an idol of. You know, and he does that same thing type here. You don't make an idol of anything. It's, you know, of a man or of an animal or of a bird or of the stars in the heavens. And so he's reminding them that he is God and there are no other gods. Don't put any of these things before me. And so I just kind of want to read through these commandments. The first one is, you shall have no other gods before me. Like clearly, you shall not make for yourself an idol. And verse 9 says, you shall not worship them or serve them, for I am the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me. And so he reminds them that he remembers the iniquity on the children of the third and fourth generation. But what does he say in verse 10? But showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. I don't know if this is correct, but when I read that, I almost think of, it says showing loving kindness. Is he talking about thousands of people or to thousands of generations? Because we know that whenever David served God, and I'm not saying that this is a qualifying number. I'm just saying that whenever David served God, what did he say about David's descendants? Anything in particular? All right, they would rule that. And he also said one of David's descendants would rule on the throne for how long? Forever, right? And so I don't know if there's talking about generations there, but that was just a thought that I had. But we know that he is going to show loving kindness to the people that keep his commandments. And then in verse 11, it says, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. Did the Israelites take this commandment seriously? Because at some point in time, whenever Christ, they were afraid to say whose name. They were even afraid to use his name, right? And today, I think we've seen some of this in the news. Are there words that are unacceptable in our society today? There are, right? Most of the words that are unacceptable in our society are degrading certain people, whether it be for race or for where they're from or how they talk. But we view those words as unacceptable. Why? Because it is trying to take one person and put them underneath other people, right? Well, what about words that would do that to God? Let's think about that for a minute. We see how our society very clearly recognizes that we shouldn't degrade one person over, you know, whatever. What about God? Who should we not be degrading at all?
Well, we degrade God when we bring him down to our level, even if we're not putting him below us. If we're bringing him down to our level, that is also degrading to him.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point, that God is so far above us, even if we try to bring him down to, you know, slightly above or equal to us or below us, how that is, you know, that would be insulting to God and would diminish who he is. And that is done by using his name in vain, right? Whenever we call on God to do something that, or call on his name for some menial type thing or to punish somebody, that is using God's name in vain. Whenever we see something that we think is amazing and we use God's name in vain, that is what this type of thing is talking about. So it's very clear for us to recognize in society certain words, but I think sometimes we hear other things so much that it's easy just to overlook those, and so we recognize how much God hates that. And then I think there at the end of verse 11, it says, "For the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain." If there's one thing we can see pretty clear in the Old Testament, does God miss punishing somebody that deserves it or has it come? He doesn't, does he? He doesn't forget about, you know, the Canaanites whenever they've been serving these idols for all these years and just kind of let it slide. He reminds us the Lord will not leave him leave him unpunished. All right. Here in verse 12, and I want to look at this one just a little bit more in a few minutes, but observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servant or your female servant or your ox or your donkey or any of your cattle, or your sojourner who stays with you, so that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out of there by a mighty hand, by an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. So he's given them this command that they're to rest on the Sabbath day. But they're not just supposed to go home and like kick back and do nothing, right? Is that the idea that's given here? They're supposed to do something while they're resting, right? They're supposed to be remembering that God had brought them out of Egypt by a mighty hand. Also, when he first gives this back in Exodus, I think we talked about this on Wednesday, he tells them that this is based on the creation. They're to remember that God had created the earth, because they rested on the seventh day because God rested on the seventh day after creating the earth. And excuse me. And so we see a lot of people can make a physical argument for the need of this day, right? It's easy to see that a person working every day, that would grow weary and tired on their bodies, right? And so we see that you can make an argument that this seventh day is basically good for our rest and allows our bodies to recover, our minds to recover. But I think it's more than that, as we talk about, it's a time for us to, not that every other 6 day we're not thinking about God, but on the seventh day they were to set that apart and let that be the main focus of their day. Chapter 16, honor your father and mother as the Lord your God has commanded you, that your days may be prolonged and that it may go well with you in the land which the Lord your God gives you. And so here we see that he gives them this command to honor your father and mother and reminds them that if they do, that their days will be prolonged. Also, we come down here to some here that doesn't give much commentary. It says, you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, and you shall not desire your neighbor's house, his field, or his male servant, or his female servant, his ox, or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. These words the Lord spoke to all the assembly at the mountain from the midst of the fire, of the cloud, and of the thick gloom with a great voice, and he added no more. He wrote on two tablets of stone and gave them to me. So here we see Moses, you know, gives them these Ten Commandments and tells them, you know, that God gave them to him there, the mountain, to give to the people.
I think there's a really significant point to me to be made from this. When you go back to, what was it, verse 2, where he said he made this covenant with us at Horeb, sometimes when we talk about the Old Covenant, we say, well, that's the Old Testament. Covenant is not really the Old Testament. The covenant are these Ten Commandments. That's the covenant. There are many other laws and statutes that are associated with it,
The Constitution is the basis of our law. Now, we have many other laws, books and books and books of laws, but the Constitution is what we go by. And that covenant was these Ten Commandments. That's the foundation of it all.
Okay, that's a very good point. All these, you know, these are the, this is the covenant, and we're going to see as we read that, what does it say about that all the laws hang on this, these, this, well, the greatest command. We see that they're all based or built around these commandments, these basic fundamental commandments that God gave us. And so, our, very good point, and thank you. And I want to, I want us to look, as we look through all of Deuteronomy, and we're not going to do this on every command, obviously, but in our minds, I want us to think about a couple of different things. The first of all is I want to think about how do these laws relate to what Christ calls the greatest commandment in Matthew chapter 22. And we've read that before, how the he's questioned, he says, well, you know, what's the greatest commandment? He says, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself. And he talks about how the whole law is hung on this command. And so I want us to think about, as we look through the commands of God, let's look, how do these laws hang on that command? How do they how do they relate to loving the Lord your the Lord our God? Another thing that I want to look at, I've looked at, we've talked about this some, is how are these commandments for the good of the nation of Israel? There's a couple of ways. One is it's going to cause them to receive the blessings, and I think that another idea is that the commands were given so that the people could have good lives as well, and that they could help each other and have a good, I want to say, you know, the word community. But the laws that God gave were for man's benefit, both spiritually, I think, and physically. And then also, I want to think about the idea of how these laws and these commands are going to set this nation apart from every other nation that's, you know, that ever existed, how they were supposed to do that. And I want to think about that in context. If they had followed this and done this, you know, what a, to use some terms, what a city set on a hill that people could have gone by and looked at and heard about from far away. And I want to look at 1 Kings, the 10th chapter. And I think this kind of gets to the idea of what was supposed to happen. I want to look at 1 Kings 10. And I'm going to read verses 1 through 9. And Solomon is reigning in Israel as king, and God is doing what to Solomon? He's giving him wisdom. He's blessing him. And so we see that, I'm going to start reading in chapter, or verse 1 of chapter 10. Now when the queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with difficult questions. What had she heard all the way down in Egypt about Solomon and about who? About God, about the Lord, concerning the name of the Lord. So she came to Jerusalem with a very large, I don't know how to say that, retune, with camels carrying spices, very much gold, precious stones. When she came to Solomon, she spoke with him about all that was in her heart. Solomon answered her questions. Nothing was hidden from the king, which he did not explain to her. When the queen of Sheba perceived all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his servants, the attendance of his waiters and their attire, his cupbearers and the stairway by which he went up to the house of the Lord, there was no more spirit in her. Then she said to the king, "It was a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. Nevertheless, I did not believe the reports until I came and my eyes had seen it. Behold, the half was not told me. You exceed in wisdom and prosperity, the report which I heard. How blessed are your men. How blessed are these servants who stand before you continually and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God who delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, therefore he made you king to do justice and righteousness. Because of the righteousness of David and the wisdom that Solomon gave him, people throughout the world, not just this queen, were hearing and knowing about who? About God. And so I think that was part of Israel's purpose. And so I want to think about how, as we look at these, we're going to, just think about yourselves how these commands would maybe, how these three things might be interrelated with those commands. And just a little bit, expound on the Sabbath a little bit. I don't know why I picked this one, but I did. We see that this is maybe, a command. One thing I read was it was a positive command. It was a command for them to do some, not to abstain from something, but it was something they were specifically supposed to do. And if you go back and look at the Exodus account, they were commanded even before I think God had given them the law. Whenever they gathered the manna, they were supposed to not gather on the seventh day. So it was kind of something. It was something that God had set aside even before he gave them the law. On the seventh day, they weren't supposed to do that. And we've already read how. How the reason they were to do that is because God had delivered them with a mighty outstretched hand. And I don't know if we talked about this on Wednesday, I may have, how as Christians today, we don't remember the Sabbath anymore. We're not commanded to, not work on the seventh day of the week and to remember these things, but we have something else that's even more important than we're supposed to remember. And that is the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. How on the day of the week that Christ was raised from the dead, he commands us that we are to remember this. Now, how serious did the Jews take the Sabbath day? Especially, I'm thinking about in the time when Christ came. They were so serious about it, they'd even made up their own laws to make it more restrictive. So how serious should we take the first day of the week when we come to remember Christ? That should be our focus for that day. Because if you think about it, what was the focus of their Sabbath day supposed to be? It was supposed to be just resting, sitting in a chair on the front porch. They were supposed to be focused on something. I think as Christians sometimes, I know that I tend to, we come to church, we take the Lord's Supper, and we don't let that be the focus maybe of our whole day or our thoughts continually throughout the day. Eddie?
All right,
very good point. Thank you. And we need to be focusing on remembering Christ and the resurrection of Christ. That's what they were supposed to remember, their creation as a nation through Christ, death, burial, and resurrection. What is our creation? We are raised a new creature, right? We have that opportunity to become a new creature. And you're right, they did focus on the negative. You weren't supposed to, you could only walk so far. I think they even got onto the apostles there as they were stripping some grain to eat and those sort of things. I didn't write down the passage, but also thinking about how, I know we talked about the Sabbath was not made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for man. What's the idea of this law? It's not made for that day. It was made for men, talking about mankind or the Israelites, so it would benefit them. And so that's the idea of remembering that is going to benefit them. I found this little chart here. I don't have it's like PowerPoint, but I want to just kind of go over it. It kind of relates some of the commands and how, where they're going to be expounded on in the book of Deuteronomy. And the first one is, authority. If you look at the first commandment there about, you know, God being who he is, and I am the Lord your God who brought you, shall have no other gods before me. We see that, you know, God is God, so he has authority, right? And also relating that to the fifth commandment, which is honor your father and mother, we see that those two commandments are maybe related by they have a central theme of authority. God clearly has authority, and we honor our parents and mother because they have authority. And those two commandments are going to be expounded upon, you know, built upon as we go through Deuteronomy. And the other one is dignity. You're to have no other gods before me. How would that be related to God's dignity? Because that would degrade him, right? That is talking about that. And how could we degrade the dignity of man? These commandments of murder. Clearly, if I murder somebody, that is degrading to them. Committing adultery, where you would degrade your spouse, or to steal. If I go and take something from you, that is degrading you. The other major issue would be commitment. That would be the idols. How they weren't supposed to worship any idols because they were to be totally committed to God, because God is the one true God. And I think also our commitment there in Commandment 9 about not bearing false witness, we're to be committed to the truth and not to anything that's false. And the last one there would be rights and privileges. And the Sabbath would be that. It would be a right or a privilege. And also not to covet would also be wanting to take somebody else's right to whatever possession that we're talking about, whether it be, there's a whole list of things there, whether it be your neighbor's wife or his ox or whatever that you might desire from your neighbor. And we see that in chapter 6 here, in verse 4 and 5, it says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. These are the words which I'm commanding you today shall be on your heart." So we see that everything is going to revolve around this great command. And just to real quick, turn over to Matthew, the 22nd chapter. Matthew 22 and verse 40. This is after Christ says, "On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets." So all the law, all the commandments, Christ says, depend on these two commandments. And they'll be built on those two commandments. Also, if we see here, this says in the beginning of this, In verse 4, it says, "The Lord, hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one." There's a couple of thoughts that I read on this. First of all, I think it's without a doubt there is one God. I think that can be stated in this, and I think that is probably what the children of Israel understood when they read that. Also, we can see that as we transfer into, you know, more revelation from God, we see that the Godhead is made up of three parts, but they're still called one. They're called, you know, there's a God, the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, but they're still considered to be one. And I don't know if that is implied in this passage, or if that's one of those passages that You know, when you have more understanding, you can look back and kind of see that in that passage.
Well, one of the things you see in all the mythical gods, the Greeks and the Egyptians, was that sometimes they conflicted with each other and they warred with each other. That's how they explained a lot of things in existence. With God, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, they are one in the sense that there's never any conflict. They're one together, one purpose, and one mind. And that's not as so I think part of what he's saying here is you believe in this oneness of God, and God will never, you'll never have God fighting over here and fighting over here against this and that. But it will always be one direction, one purpose. And I think that's how men hear it in this God, not even he one.
From what I understand, Hebrew scholars, they said there's actually two different words in Hebrew that are translated by our English word one. One of them just means one less than two. But the word that is used here is a word that actually means this idea of being united, which would, you know, you've alluded to the point that Dan is making there, that, you know, it's not really saying that there's not more than one God, although that's true, but it's really saying that God is unified. That God is united.
All right. And looking forward to us as Christians, what are we called to be? United, to be one. And how is it possible all these different Christians could be united or be one?
United in God.
United in God, looking at God's commands and conforming to that. Because I'm sure we all have different opinions about everything. I like banana pudding. Some people don't like banana pudding. But it's not about our opinion about what we should do to serve God. It's about when we read the words of God, and if we can conform to that, then we can be united with each other, and more importantly, we can be united with God, right? Because we can be one with Him. And I think that idea is discussed, you know, in the New Testament. We've had other studies on that, but let's see, where am I? I want to talk a little bit about, it says that you shall love the Lord God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. That's three different ways he explains that we're supposed to love God. So I want to think about heart. What do you think about when you think about loving the Lord God with all your heart? Is that sometimes I think today we think of, you know, an emotional feeling, like whenever I see, you know, a puppy, I love that puppy with my heart. It's an emotional attachment because the puppies are cute, right? Because they're happy to see you and they wag their tails and hopefully they don't mess in the floor. Is that what he's talking about, this attraction like you'd have to a puppy? One of the things I read was in this, the language that was written in, they didn't have a word for mind, right? So this is an idea of mind, where we love God with our minds. How do you love God with your mind? I think you can, you recognize, you rationalize, first of all, what? That He exists. And so I think that this idea that you love Him with your mind, you rationalize that He exists, that His laws are good, and that's my understanding of that. I'm sure that is incomplete. Does anybody else have any thoughts on how you would love God with all your heart? Mike?
A really easy comparison that you'll hear, you know, people talk about athletes, and they play like with a lot of heart, or maybe the simple, you know, observation is, you know, they're dedicated to it and they put all their being into whatever they're doing.
Okay, so you okay. And typically they talk about an athlete that plays with all his heart. Maybe he doesn't have as much talent as somebody else, but we can see he has that desire. But what about soul? How do we love God with all of our soul? I think, you know, our heart is something that is our mind, our thoughts. To me, that is something that is physical, and I can kind of wrap my hands around a little bit. Go ahead.
I can see it as identity. You wrap up your identity
All right, your identity. That is who you are. That is your soul. Ted?
It's got to be so much more than just a decision.
Okay.
I don't make the decision to love my children. But this is making a decision in how I live, what I engage in, who I surround myself with, fill my brain with. You know, it's obviously. Very good point. In case you didn't hear, she was saying that it's like whenever we sing the song, "My God is my everything." It's not, I think that in these three answers, you all have kind of wrapped up this idea, in a way, of what it is to love God with all your soul. And so I think it's that brings in, I think, our desires and our willingness to change our will to match God's will. Like he said, it becomes our identity. Who we are, it changes us to make us, and that's, you know, our soul is this thing that we share in common with God that separates us from all other creation. And I think that is conforming our soul that was created in the image of God to God, where we change that's who we become, that changes our wills. Any other thoughts on this, or have I made everybody really confused? Or then I want to look at the other part of this where we love God with all of our might. The Israelites were about to do what? They were about to go into Canaan and physically conquer. And now we know that God was going to be the one that did that, because under their own strength, they couldn't have gone and defeated these nations that were there. And so they were going to have to use all their strength to do that as well. And so they were going to have to go in and be the ones that physically, you know, put to death. They were commanded to put these people to death with the sword. So they were going to have to do that. I think that would have been very difficult to do. But they were going to have to do that with all their might. But how do we do that today with all of our might? By resisting temptation, by using our strengths that God has given us to do His will, and that type of thing. So we use that, we do that with all of our might, with all of our effort, is the thoughts that, did somebody raise their?
Worn out, but that we are worn out serving God. well, I'll do what's easy. This is not doing what's easy.
Yeah, and if you just do that kind of, you know, easily way or without all your strength, you're really not doing it the way that God wants us to be doing it. And so I think if you combine all these things together, that this excludes half-hearted service, doesn't it? Where we come to church on Sunday morning and we live our lives how we want to do it, or we come to church and we just kind of take it as, you know, a part of our life. It's not, it doesn't change who we are. It just, and I think that with a lot of people in society, yeah, and if you listen to music, they talk about going to church on Sunday morning, but on Saturday night they were out doing things that, you know, are contrary to God's will. That's not how you love God with all your heart, soul, and might. That is half-hearted. And so it's supposed to be, as we see, changing who we are. There's only one person in the Old Testament that's ever quoted as loving God with all of his heart and soul, and that was King Josiah in 2 Kings, the 23rd chapter. Second Kings 23 and verse 25. It says, Before him there was no king like him, who turned to the Lord with all his heart, with all his soul, with all his might, according to all the law of Moses, nor did any like him arise after. Can you think of what a compliment that is to him? There was nobody, no other king that turned and followed this the way that he did. And also, if we look in 2 Chronicles, the 34th chapter, and beginning in verse 14, this is talking about them. They're going in, they're looking through the temple. And it says, when they were digging out the money which had been brought into the house of the Lord, Hilkiah the priest found the book of the law of the Lord given by Moses. Now, I was talking to Eddie, and he was talking the other day how this most likely was what book? The book of Deuteronomy. So they found the book that we're studying right now. And let's look at what an effect it had on Josiah. And Hilkiah responded and said to Shaphan the scribe, I have found the book of the law in the house of the Lord, and Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan. Then Shaphan brought the book to the king and reported further word to the king, saying, everything that was entrusted to your servants they are doing. They have also emptied out the money which was found in the house of the Lord and have delivered it into the hands of the supervisors and the workmen. Moreover, Shaphan the scribe told the king, saying, Hilkiah the priest gave me a book, and Shaphan read from it in the presence of the king. When the king heard these words of the law, he tore his clothes. Then the king commanded Hilkiah, the son of Shaphan, the scribe, the servant, saying, go inquire the Lord for me those who are left in Judea concerning the words of the book which has been found. For great is the wrath of the Lord, which is poured out on us because our fathers have not observed the word of the Lord to do according to all that is written in this book. When he read this book, he tore his clothes because he understood that they had not been following this law. And he recognized that what was due to them based on this book, the curses, right? And so he recognized that he tore his clothes because he knew that they had failed. Now, do we want to be like Josiah? So what should we do whenever we read God's law and we recognize that we have not been following the things that were written by God? And so that's kind of where I want to end at today, since that's the bell. We'll start back there on Wednesday. Thank you for everybody's participation.